It's my great pleasure and privilege to greet you all in the name of Jesus this morning and to have such good participation already. And we've already spent some time in 1 Peter. You can turn back there to 1 Peter 2. And we'll go down to verse 15. For so is the will of God, that with well-doing ye may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men, as free, and not using your liberty for a cloak of maliciousness, but as the servants of God. So, several years ago, Dale Eby gave a powerful message at the Berean meetings titled, Is the Heart All That Matters? I carried that CD around in my truck. I had that in the CD player for a long time. And then the children started driving the truck, and they wanted to listen to other things, and I think the CD got lost at some point after that. But I listened to that message a lot, and it was a very, very powerful message. But I want to turn that around a little bit this morning and just kind of get right to the question, does the outside matter? You know, from time to time in our communities, you can hear some negative things about more, let's call them more conservative churches. Oh, you know, the old orders and those others. Well, they look good, but they do this and this and that. And, oh, they can just be such hypocrites. And isn't that exactly what you hear if you're around liberal Mennonites saying about us? Does that happen? And it doesn't just stop there. It's not just an Anabaptist thing. You know, the Baptists might say that about liberal Mennonites. The Episcopalians might say that about the Baptists. Oh, they look good, but what's really on the inside? And then the Methodists might say that about the Episcopalians. It goes just all the way down the line. Basically, if the things that you do, your outside looks like it's stricter than mine, it must be wrong. There's got to be something wrong there. There's got to be something wrong back there. So is that true? Is an outward appearance of righteousness just a cover for hypocrisy? And even if we would assume it was true of others, how should that affect the things that we do? How should that matter to us? Is the right answer to just reject outward displays of our faith? Or does it really even matter how we look or what are the things that we do? 1 Peter 3:14 says, But and if ye suffer for righteousness' sake, happy are ye, and be not afraid of their terror, neither be troubled. But sanctify the Lord God in your hearts, and be ready always to give an answer to every man that asketh you, a reason of the hope that is in you, with meekness and with fear. Having a good conscience that, whereas they speak evil of you as of evildoers, they may be ashamed that falsely accuse your good conversation in Christ. For it is better, if the will of God be so, that ye suffer for well-doing than for evil-doing. So these are questions we'll be asked. Why do you do this? Why do you look that way? Why does it matter? Why isn't the heart all that matters? Is the outside important? How should we express our inner faith? If we are to be holy because he is holy, what is that supposed to look like? Is holiness supposed to be an inner quality just between us and God? Or is it something that other people can see? And if so, what effect should that have on them and on us? Do we have the answer? Do these questions even matter? Or are we creating a problem where there isn't one? Well, 1 Peter 5:8 says, Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary the devil, as a roaring lion, walketh about, seeking whom he may devour. So yes, how we live out our faith is important, because we have an enemy who is watching for us to stumble and anxious to just give us that little push the rest of the way down to the ground. So let's have a look this morning at Have a Ready Answer. Does the outside matter? So what is the outside? Now, this isn't limited to just conservative Anabaptist traditions. The outside is dress, speech, actions, the places we go, the people we associate with, the things that people can see when they look at us. Really, any action or adornment that might be considered to be pious in any way. Paul said of the Cretans in Titus 1:16 that they profess to know God, but in works they deny him, being abominable, disobedient, and disqualified for every good work. So the Cretans claimed to have faith, but their works proved otherwise. No one looking at them would think that they were Christians. So much so that God found them abominable, hateful, useless for any good work. And when people tell you, oh, I believe in God, but then there's nothing in their lives to show it, this is the situation that they're in. Disqualified for every good work, abominable in the face of God. But we have true faith, don't we? We've got it all together. Well, if so, should people be able to look at us or watch us and deduce that we're Christians? Now, the old question goes, if you were accused of being a Christian, would there be enough evidence to convict you? Now, if they can deduce that we're Christians, is it inevitable then that we will eventually bring shame to the faith when we do unchristian things? Because we're human and we fall. So should we then just simply reject outward displays of our faith out of fear that we'll be accused of hypocrisy? We'll turn over to Mark 12. And go down to verse 38. And then he, Jesus, said to them in his teaching, "Beware of the scribes who desire to go around in long robes, love greetings in the marketplaces, the best seats in the synagogues, and the best places at the feasts, who devour widows' houses and for a pretense make long prayers. These will receive greater condemnation." Now, this is the short version of Jesus' accusations to the scribes and the Pharisees in Matthew 23. But it's enough for us here. We don't really need the whole discussion. Both the scribes and the Pharisees were considered by the people to be very religious. But the actions Jesus describes here are anything but. Is it because we're so struck by this accusation that we're willing sometimes to just look like everyone else and not stand out as Christians? If we do that, what does that look like? What does it look like if we have no external expression of our faith? If we look just like everybody else in the world, maybe we're secret Christians. What does that look like? Do we look like eagles? It's kind of the opposite, isn't it? I think it makes us look a lot like buzzards. So, you know, when you see buzzards on the ground, it's just not very nice, is it? I mean, they're there in a big group tearing at some poor dead animal, and they fuss with each other over this bit or that bit and push each other around. They're squawking, make horrible noises. And you ever see them sitting in the trees in the morning? You know, after they've eaten and been digging through the animal on the side of the road, they hang their wings out, just kind of let everything dry up there in the trees. And they're about the most singularly ugly creatures that God put out there. And you just don't look at a bunch of them and think, man, I'd like to be one of them. Do you? It just really doesn't come up. But when they fly. When I was a park ranger, I was driving the park truck down a fire road one day, and there was this big turkey buzzard standing in the middle of the road. And he looked at me, he gave me that eyeball that only buzzards can really give you. And he just turned away from the truck, and he spread his wings out, and the wingtip went from one end of the road to the other edge of the road. And it was just beat, beat, and he was airborne. And he just took off, and it was just magnificent. And when you see them, when they catch an updraft and you watch them whirling around in the sky, they're just magnificent creatures. They can just stay aloft all day long, right in the air currents, looking down, waiting for something to eat or to see what's going on down there. They're really sharp eyes, too. And so all of a sudden, that horrible, ugly-looking creature is just magnificent. And who wouldn't want to fly like that? Wouldn't you like to be able to spread your arms out and take off on the winds and go wherever they took you? I'm afraid that that's really a good picture of the modern church. Most of the time, just as ugly as the whole rest of the world, but we're capable of just soaring so beautifully. We still do such beautiful things when we remember that we serve Christ. Luke 6:46, Jesus says, "But why do you call me Lord, Lord, and not do the things which I say?" Is it okay to be ugly as long as we have those moments of beauty? Aren't we called to do better than that? We're called to be more than buzzards. 1 Peter 1:15 says, "But as he which hath called you is holy, so be ye holy in all manner of conversation, because it is written, be ye holy, for I am holy." So why would we ever settle for less? What prevents us? What keeps us from being holy, being beautiful all the time? Sometimes it's just three little words. Holier than thou. Have you ever heard that? You're just holier than thou. Well, if you have family who've left the church, or if you came to the church from a family that's not, well, conservative, you've heard it a lot. Quite a lot. You're just being holier than thou. Well, why should your personal quest for holiness offend others? Especially people in your family who supposedly love you. Why do they feel like your holiness is about them? Why do they think it somehow hits them? Well, Matthew 6:1, Jesus says, "Take heed that ye do not your alms before men, to be seen of them. Otherwise ye have no reward of your Father which in heaven." Is that the problem? Does that mean that we should always live our faith in secret so as not to offend other people around us who don't maybe share it? Well, Jesus is referring here specifically to giving. Right? Don't make a show of giving so that men will see how much you give and think good things about you. Oh, look, he's a good giver. He's generous. The point applies to our outside as well, though. Do we appear the way we do in order to please God or because we think that will please men? So does that mean we shouldn't appear the way we do because we have our heart wrong? It means we have to get our heart right, doesn't it? Most often, we will hear holier than thou from friends or family that our walk has become different than. We started to talk about that in Sunday school, but really didn't go anywhere because most of us were raised in the church, I think. But if you weren't raised in the church and you suddenly become part of the church, you find very quickly you lose a lot of friends and you lose a lot of family. And suddenly they have nothing good to say about you But in these cases, holier than thou can usually be translated as, you think you're better than me. Or more specifically, you think you're better than me because of your religion. So should our response to that be to stop pursuing holiness? Well, certainly not. But it should call us to examine our interactions with those around us. Does that reaction come from a lack of humility on my part? Galatians 6:3 says, "For if anyone thinks himself to be something when he is nothing, he deceives himself." You know, my dad smoked for pretty much all his life. And he used to say, there's nothing worse than a reformed smoker. You know, a minute ago, he was there having a cigarette with you. And now he's quit, and you have to too. Well, yeah, it's true. He feels so much better when he quits smoking that he wants you to feel better too. But it doesn't come out that way, or it's not taken that way. It's taken as, I'm better than you now because I was able to quit and you're not. If we present ourselves as better than others, there's always going to be a backlash. But we naturally want those we love to come along with us as we walk closer to Christ. But we have to learn to encourage them with love and kindness. Do we have any right to feel superior? Well, Galatians 6:14 says, "But God forbid that I should boast except in the cross of our Lord Jesus Christ, by whom the world has been crucified to me and I to the world." On the other hand, they may be angry with you because they're convicted by the change in your life, but they're not ready or willing to make that change themselves. Romans 10:3 says, "For they, being ignorant of God's righteousness, and going about to establish their own righteousness, have not submitted themselves unto the righteousness of God." Everybody wants to be good. They want to have a good life, a happy life, raise their children up. But without God in their life, they can't do it, no matter how hard they strive. So you're holier than them. I'm kind of ornery. I like to ask, well, then, just how holy would I need to be holier than them? It's a fair question. As Paul says, most people pursue being good in their own strength. But without submission to God, they will fail. And being holy isn't something that we can just set aside for another person's convenience. It is just not an option. Leviticus 20:26 says, "And you shall be holy to me, for I, the Lord, am holy and have separated you from the peoples that you should be mine." We belong to the Lord. We are set aside for his use and we will be holy. But it's such a hard thing. It just causes all this conflict and risk. So why does God demand it? Why is being holy an outside thing? Why can't it just be something that's between me and God? Why isn't the heart all that matters? Well, first of all, it's because we are changed. We have been transformed. Our faith is visible on the outside. It makes us look differently than we did before, and act differently than we did before, because we are different than we were before. We are changed from the inside out. Ezekiel 3:26 says, "A new heart also will I give you, and a new spirit will I put within you. And I will take away the stony heart out of your flesh, and I will give you a heart of flesh. And I will put my spirit within you and cause you to walk in my statutes, and you shall keep my judgments and do them." Not only does God change our hearts, take the stony heart out of us and give us a soft and compassionate heart, but we will walk and keep and do. If the heart is changed, the body acts. Turn over to Mark 5. I'll start at verse 2. And when he was come out of the ship, immediately there met him out of the tombs a man with an unclean spirit, who had his dwelling among the tombs, and no man could bind him, no, not with chains, because that he had often been bound with fetters and chains, and the chains had been plucked asunder by him, and the fetters broken in pieces, and neither could any man tame him. And always, night and day, he was in the mountains and in the tombs, crying and cutting himself with stones. But when he saw Jesus afar off, he ran and worshipped him, and cried with a loud voice and said, What have I to do with thee, Jesus, thou Son of the Most High God? I adjure thee by God that thou torment me not. For he said unto him, Come out of the man, thou unclean spirit. And he asked him, What is thy name? And he answered, saying, My name is Legion, for we are many. Notice the man's state. He's uncontrollable. He couldn't be bound with chains, crying and yelling, cutting himself all the day and all the night, hiding in the mountains away from any comfort from any man. A little farther down, Mark to verse 15, we know the rest of the story. And verse 15 says, And they come to Jesus and see him that was possessed with the devil and had the legion sitting and clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. Now these people had had compassion on this man. They had tried to tie him up to keep him from hurting himself. They had tried to keep him at least safe if they couldn't get him into his right mind. And they had failed, and he had run away from them. And now they come and they see him sitting in his right mind. He's got his hair combed, he's dressed, and they're afraid. They're not rejoicing that the devils are gone, that the man is himself. They're afraid. Make no mistake, we may not have been inhabited by 1,000 demons, but without Christ, our end would be no better than that man's. The change in our lives should be no less visible. When the people we spent our former life with see us and see the change in us, it should frighten them. They should see the hand of God. They should be afraid, and they should want what we have to not be afraid anymore. Our life is changed. Our outside provides an example to others to come to Christ. Turn over to 1 Timothy 4. Down to verse 12. And Paul writes, Let no man despise thy youth, but be thou an example of the believers in word, in conversation, in charity, in spirit, in faith, in purity. Till I come, give attendance to reading, to exhortation, to doctrine. Neglect not the gift that is in thee, which was given by thee by prophecy, with the laying on of the hands of the presbytery. Word, conversation, charity, love, spirit, faith, purity. These are all visible things. These are all things that are not just for ourselves to have inside, but things for others to see and to experience. Now, you may think he's just talking about ministry here, but all of you, when you were baptized, did not the presbytery lay their hands upon you? This is all of us. To not be exemplary in these things would be to neglect the gift that we've been given. Over in Titus 2, verse 6, Paul writes, "Likewise, urge the young men to be sensible. In all things, show yourself to be an example of good deeds, with purity in doctrine, dignified, sound speech, which is beyond reproach, so that the opponent will be put to shame, having nothing bad to say about us." I use the New American Standard there because they use the word example specifically. King James did not. But we are to be an example. Again, good deeds, pure teaching, dignified, sound speech to build up others and provide an example. Things that we keep to ourselves cannot show the way to those around us. Our outward expression of faith is important because it encourages other Christians. Back to 1 Peter 5, verse 8. "Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary the devil, as a roaring lion, walketh about, seeking whom he may devour, whom resist steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same afflictions are accomplished in your brethren that are in the world." You are not alone in your walk. As you resist and walk apart from the world, others are encouraged and strengthened to do the same. In order to be encouraged, they have to see you. They have to see that there are others like them. I follow this forum. It's mostly political articles that he posts. But every evening, he has what he calls an open thread, where people who watch can just post anything they want to. And I like to go to that because sometimes people have a lot more in-depth articles linked than you would find on the normal pages, and I can read those. But a lot of people just kind of made it a community, and they just go and talk to each other there. We're just a world where we're hungry for companionship, I think, and people like that electronic companionship, and they know they're among like-minded people. But sometimes things get really personal, and one man on there had just brought his wife home from the hospital to be on hospice. And every night, he started posting in the open thread about their day together and what had happened and how it had gone and how he had been encouraged, how she was doing, and how they were blessed. Their church was wonderful through all this. And there was someone from the church there every day that she was on hospice. And they really thought she was only going to live 2 or 3 days the time they got home. And it turned out she lived about a month and a half. And there was time for all the family to come, and she was lucid the whole time. And it was a wonderful time. And she passed here a couple weeks ago. And so he wrote, I just want to read you this one post that he wrote. He had asked his wife what he could do for her after she was gone. And she told him, "I want you to start a nationwide revival." That's big leaving task for a man in his 70s. So he says, "Since my wife charged me with triggering nationwide revival, I thought I ought to get started. I think she was just kidding, of course, but maybe I can inspire some to start reviving. The media made a big deal about a recent survey showing unaffiliated to be the largest category of religious belief in the U.S. Of course, that's only because they broke Christianity into so many different categories that no single category is larger than 23% that claim to be unaffiliated. However, 70% belong to one of the Christian categories. But the enemy wants us to believe that Christianity is dying, and even many Christians have bought into this. In getting people to think that Christianity is dying, they hope to get more people to either abandon the faith or, at a minimum, to take it less seriously. So every time I leave the house, I wear something that identifies me as a Christian. Typically, I wear one of two hats. One says, 'With God, all things are possible.' The other, 'Jesus is the only way.' In warmer weather, I'll often wear a t-shirt with a Christian message on it. Why do I do this? Because it lets other Christians know they are not alone. I wish every Christian did this. There's another reason. It reminds me to act like a Christian, to be friendly, to be helpful, pick up trash, to straighten the cart corral, or whatever. You know, we don't wear t-shirts with Christian messages on them, at least not out where everybody can see them. But your plain coat, your cape dress, your head covering, they're recognized by most everyone who sees them as Christian symbols. Now, some people despise those symbols. But whenever you go out, there is the chance that you will pass someone who is struggling with their faith, afraid to show their faith, feeling like they're all alone in their faith. And you can encourage your brother or sister just by passing by. Why would we ever give up that kind of easy opportunity to share the word? And as he implied, our faith, our outward expression, our outside, is a reminder to ourselves. We were driving down the road the other day and got behind this van and had this sticker on it. And it was over on the edge of the van. And it was this kind of this Catholic portrayal of Jesus you only see with the red stole and the white and his hand up and the peace sign. And he's like leaning out into the window. And next to it, it says, "I saw that. I saw that." I thought, I want one of those stickers. I know I really can't have one, but it was pretty good. We live incredibly busy and distractive lives. Do we remember who we serve? Do we remember that Jesus does see everything and he cares? Do we serve Christ each and every day? Are the things that we do done to honor our King? Turn to Matthew 24. And down to verse 45. Who then is a faithful and wise servant whom his master made rule over his household to give them food in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his master, when he comes, will find so doing. Assuredly, I say unto you that he will make him ruler over all his goods. But if that evil servant says in his heart, my master is delaying his coming, and begins to beat his fellow servants and to eat and drink with the drunkards, the master of that servant will come on a day when he is not looking for him, at an hour that he is not aware of, and will cut him in two and appoint him his portion with the hypocrites. And there shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Notice the portion with the hypocrites is death. Do the things we do each day, the way we work, the people we associate with, the things we put on, remind us that the Master is coming soon and we work for him. Our outside is also evidence of our faith, not just to the people around us, but to God. In Mark 7:6, Jesus answered and said unto them, well hath Isaiah prophesied of you hypocrites, as it is written, this people honoreth me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. It is not enough to say we believe in God. It's not enough to say we love the Lord. Action is required. There is a do. Flip back to Matthew 22. I'm starting at verse 1. And Jesus answered and spoke to them again by parables and said, the kingdom of heaven is like a certain king who arranged a marriage for his son and sent out his servants to call those who were invited to the wedding, and they were not willing to come. And again, he sent out other servants, saying, tell those who are invited, see, I have prepared my dinner, my oxen and fatted cattle are killed, and all things are ready. Come to the wedding. But they made light of it and went their ways, one to his own farm, another to his business. And the rest seized his servants, treated them spitefully, and killed them. But when the king heard about it, he was furious, and he sent his armies, destroyed those murderers, and burnt up their city. And then he said to his servants, "The wedding is ready, but those who were invited were not worthy. Therefore, go into the highways, and as many as you find, invite to the wedding." And so the servants went out into the highways and gathered together all whom they found, both bad and good. And the wedding hall was filled with guests. But when the king came in to see the guests, he saw a man there who did not have on a wedding garment. And so he said to him, "Friend, how did you come in here without a wedding garment?" And he was speechless. And then the king said to the servants, "Bind him hand and foot, take him away, and cast him out to outer darkness. And there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth, for many are called, but few are chosen." What is the wedding garment? I'd love to tell you it's a plain coat. I really would. But no, that's not going to fly. Do we even know what Jesus was talking about? Obviously, the people he was talking to understood this whole thing about the wedding garment. And we have instances throughout the Old Testament where a change of clothes, a garment, was given as a gift. We can assume a rich king would invite people to the wedding and provide them with proper clothing to wear. We're not so rich, but we kind of do that, right? The bridesmaids, they wear what the bride says when we have a wedding that way. And the groomsmen, they wear what the groom says. And so it's not such a strange idea. I mean, we know the wedding is the wedding of the Lamb and the church. And the unworthy, well, they're the Jews who rejected Christ. And those who are brought in from the streets, the good and the bad, they're us, right? They're the Gentiles. The garment, then, is the robes washed white in the blood of the Lamb. It's your salvation. That's the garment that gets you admission to the wedding. But is it more than that? Is it more than just, "I'm saved"? Your Revelations 3, 4, and 5 says, "Thou hast a few names, even in Sardis, which have not defiled their garments, and they shall walk with me in white, for they are worthy. He that overcometh, the same shall be clothed in white raiment, and I will not blot out his name out of the book of life, but I will confess his name before my Father and before his angels." We see the same symbolism in Revelations 3:18, in Revelations 19:8, in 1 Peter 5, in Isaiah 1:18, in Psalm 109. It leads us to see that the garment is not just clothing. The garment of the man is his habits of good or evil character, which is manifested to others. It's more than just saying I'm good. It's being good. It's the garment of holiness that Jesus provides with our salvation, without which no man shall see the Lord. More is expected to us, of us, than just showing up. Luke 6:46 says, "And why call ye me Lord, Lord, and not do the things which I say? Whosoever cometh to me and heareth my sayings and doeth them, I will show you whom he is like. He is like a man which built a house and digged deep and laid the foundation on a rock. And when the flood arose, the stream beat vehemently upon that house and could not shake it, for it was founded upon a rock. But he that heareth and doeth not is like a man without a foundation built a house upon the earth, against which the stream did beat vehemently, and immediately it fell, and the ruin of that house was great." Our outside, our appearance, our good Christian walk is also notice to the enemy, to the devil, that we no longer belong to him. Ephesians 6:11 says, "Put on the whole armor of God, that ye may be able to stand against the wiles of the devil." Continuing in the world leaves us weak and open to temptation and failure. Pursuing a holy life strengthens our armor and makes us strong to stand. 1 John 3:10 says, "In this the children of God are manifest, and the children of the devil. Whosoever doeth not righteousness is not of God, neither he that loveth not his brother. We cannot claim to belong to God and not walk with God. And that's why we put these things on. Finally, the things that we do because we love Christ give us the courage to share the gospel. I flip over to Matthew 10. And down to verse 27. And Jesus says, "What I tell you in darkness, that speak ye in light. What ye hear in the ear, that preach ye upon the housetops. And fear not them which kill the body, but are able not able to kill the soul, but rather fear him which is able to destroy both soul and body in hell. Are not two sparrows sold for a farthing? And one of them shall not fall on the ground without your Father. But the very hairs of your head are all numbered. Fear ye not, therefore, ye are of more value than many sparrows. Whosoever therefore shall confess me before men, him will I confess also before my Father which is in heaven. But whosoever shall deny me before men, him will I also deny before my Father which is in heaven." When you make the outward statement that you belong to Christ, when you tell the gospel story, when you change the things that you do to reflect your relationship with Christ, then you confess Christ. "Fear not, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom." Shall we have a song?